in the case of Hills versus Westminster, and we're ready to hear from the petition.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Brown. I represent Corey Hills, and we're here to discuss the question of speedy trial. I don't think anyone on either side of the aisle disputes that speedy trial is an extremely fundamental right. It's a right under the rules, it's a statutory right, it's a constitutional right. Justice delayed is justice denied. The Colorado has taken the position, and referring to Sweet versus Myers, which is a long-standing case and is referred to in our reply brief, that there is every presumption shall be indulged in favor of the defendant's right to a speedy trial. I don't think there can be any question that speedy trial versus chronic court congestion, speedy trial trumps. I think that's the situation we have in this case. The trial court in the Westminster Municipal Court applied an automatic tolling theory. And at the second court appearance on June 8th, the trial court made very clear that its view was that if defense counsel is offered a date, can't make that date for any reason, the speedy trial is tolled for that period of time.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there? I mean,
sure.
In the sense that the date was offered, and maybe you can help me understand what happened at that point. And the attorney says, I'm sorry, I can't make it. Did the attorney say, let's try these other dates? Or is that not the obligation of the attorney to offer some other dates that might work?
If I could back up a little to answer the question.
Sure.
First, there was the date of April the 11th. And on April the 11th, prior counsel appeared, had my calendar, and advised the court that I was available on June 1st, June 8th, June 22nd, and June 15th. The court said June 1st works. It works for everybody. And that probably should have been the end of the day. However, then the city attorney stands up and says, well, wait a minute, since Mr. Brown's only available for the first time on June 1st, that must imply that he's not available on those other dates. And so at that juncture, the court said, I'll just note that for the record. That became very important on June 8th. From June, the city couldn't do June 1st, so it got kicked over to June 8th. So then on June 8th, we show up, and the court can't do it on June 8th, and offered one date, and that was the date of July 6th, and I couldn't do July 6th. So we were giving one date of July 6th. The issue of whether or not those other dates were available, the issue of whether or not Division B was available for that period of time from June the 8th to July the 6th, during that period of time, which is still within speedy, was never addressed by the court. It's our position that in this situation, and there's cases that support this, that the burden of compliance of speedy trial doesn't rest with me, it rests with the court. And so what happened is the court said, does July 6th work? And I said, no, that date doesn't work. So the court immediately suggested a date outside the speedy trial, which was August 3rd. I made my objection, and that was the end. Sure.
I can't remember whether it was in your briefing or the city attorney's, but it was, I got the impression that you were given 2 days. You personally suggested 2 days in July, which were beyond the speedy trial date, but not in August 3rd. Is that?
Can you
explain that sequence? Because that, by suggesting those dates, what occurs to me is that maybe that announcement where taken out of the statutory amendment.
Well, first of all, is it a waiver? Is it an express?
Okay,
what happened is the court said, July 6th available? And I said, no. And I said, there's another date in July that works.
That was post-July 10th.
That was post-July
10th.
Right. Now, what's important, I would suggest, is this. What happens normally in this situation is the court says, well, I think I'm going to give you a date of August 3rd. Or let's assume July 27th. This is, the court would say, normally, this is beyond speedy trial. I'm going to ask for a waiver. That never happened.
But you, you objected to the August 3rd or 6th date, whatever.
August 3rd, yes, I did.
Okay. But that's a little inconsistent with you saying I'm going to be available to try it these 2 days in July, which are also beyond the speedy trial 90-day movement for the Senate.
Sure.
So how do you explain all that?
There was a huge issue, a matter of confusion on that date as to when speedy trial was up. The court felt that those earlier dates were told and that August 3rd was perfectly acceptable. So I was just saying, Judge, I've got some dates that are available. I'm not going to come in and say I don't have anything else that's available.
And this is part of that too. Is there something in the record that the judge says, because we continue that we couldn't do it on July 6th, the windows taken out? Is that in our record?
Yes. Let me tell you what the court said on June the 8th. The court said, Mr. Brown, and this is the first time the court even addressed this issue. Do you recall or your prior counsel back in April advised the court that you were not available on 5 dates, the end of April and in May, and it's always on a Friday. And so the court said it's the court's position that those, that activity or that conduct constitutes a tolling. And so if we toll those prior dates, August 3rd is perfectly fine. If indeed those 5 dates are tolled, then we lose. August 3rd is within speedy trial. And that, in our position, is the error the trial court made. So I don't think there was a waiver.
Specific finding by the judge, legal finding that by being unavailable, the record reflects that he said time is over.
Oh, absolutely. What he says specifically is he says, quote, the rule says that, and I'm assuming you're referring to the municipal rule, he says that the rule tells me that indeed if council doesn't accept a date, there is a tolling. And he's very specific about the dates in April and May. And so the trial court felt that August the 3rd was within speedy trial. And because of that error, he never asked, hey,
wrong with the trial court's theory?
Okay. There's only one case that comes close to suggesting that what the trial court did was appropriate, and that's the Wilson decision. That's the case that the Colorado Court of Appeals relied on. Because we have a situation such as Tassert v. Yeager and other cases where simply declining a date doesn't toll speedy trial. So we need to discuss the Wilson case. In Wilson, the trial counsel had, he was a public defender, had 3 trials, and this is the only case, in my view, and I can explain why, that supports what the trial court did in the city of Westminster. In the People v. Wilson decision that the Court of Appeals relied heavily on, the defense lawyer had 3 trials the same day, and that was on December 16th, 1996. And so the court said we can't do 3 trials on the same day. We're going to have to bump one of the cases to January 2nd, which was the last day of speedy trial. And the defense in that case said, obviously, that period of time is chargeable to the defense. And that was the Wilson case. Clearly, this period of time was chargeable to the defense. And they stipulated that this period of time was chargeable to the defense. However, we don't have that here. We don't have a situation. What we have is quite the opposite. On June the 8th, we are ready for trial. The city was ready for trial on June the 8th. The court wasn't. The court had to bump the case because of court congestion. Now, what we have is, it's interesting, on June the 8th, if we adhere to this tolling theory, then only 1 week of June the 1 to June the 8th was tolled, what was used at all. In other words, if everything in April and May is tolled, and the first date the court gave us was June the 1st. The city couldn't do June the 1st. The victim wasn't available, so we did June the 8th. When we show up on June the 8th, when the court evaluates what cases are we going to prioritize for speedy trial and what cases not, the court at that juncture felt that the Hills case only had 7 days of speedy trial that had been used at all. And the court felt we have plenty of time to try this case. In fact, August 3rd is okay. The Wilson case doesn't apply to this situation. The cases cited by the city, starting with the Bates decision and all of the other cases, all deal with a situation where a court date is suggested outside of speedy trial, and the defendant either says, yes, we will accept a date outside of speedy trial, or, as in Chavez, is noncommittal and doesn't object to a trial outside of speedy trial. That didn't happen in our case. So the question is, what should the court have done on June the 8th? They offer one date. They should have asked the defendant, well, since we're going into August, and since we're maybe going outside of speedy trial, they should have asked the defendant for a waiver of speedy trial. Do you waive speedy trial?
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
You say they should have done. Is there a textual basis for that? And maybe you can make it clear to me, you're not making any argument but that 18.1405 controls what is a delay or what is a continuance and how to calculate time.
Sure.
We're all agree with that.
Right.
So when you say what the judge should have done, is there a textual basis for that? Is there anything that says what a judge has to do in deciding to set a trial as long as he sets it within speedy trial?
If he sets a trial outside of speedy trial without a legitimate exception to the rule, he needs a waiver of speedy trial. And that didn't happen in this case for a very important reason, is because the court apparently wasn't clear when speedy trial was up. But I think we could easily argue that the record suggests that the court thought that August 3rd was within speedy trial, and therefore did not ask for a waiver.
And I guess, and I don't want to throw you off too much here, but
sure.
Kind of this point, we had an offer by the trial judge of a date within speedy trial,
mm-hmm.
and you declined.
Right.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, is there some suggestion on your part that there is a textual basis for the judge having to find a suitable a time that is that would accommodate your schedule within speedy trial, or does he just have to set a trial sometime within speedy trial? And if you
sure, there's a case.
Not take that, what's the situation then? Have you asked for a continuance in effect?
The language of People versus Arledge, which some members of this court addressed in 1997, has some language that's very instructive. In the Arledge case, there was also a problem with setting within speedy trial. And this court held that speedy trial was violated. This court held that the trial court has an obligation to reasonably explore alternatives to whether or not we can fit the case in within speedy trial. In the Arledge decision, it was suggested that the trial court failed to find out if there was dates in another division that might have worked. As the record suggests, in this case, there's a Division A and a Division B. Hills got bumped because there was a case in Division A and there was a case in Division B. So when the court offers one date and says, what about July 6th, Mr. Brown? And Mr. Brown says, I can't do July 6th. The Arledge decision suggests that the court had an obligation to, at a minimum, see if there was some dates available in Division B. In other words, the court, since speedy trial is so important, does have an obligation to make reasonable efforts to ascertain whether or not a speedy trial can be complied with or not. And that simply wasn't done.
Under your theory, when did the speedy trial expire?
July the 10th.
What?
Right, July 10th.
Okay. And that was based on the fact that a new 90-day period started the case when the original lawyer dropped out?
On April the 11th, yes.
Yeah. Mr. Brown?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Just to follow up on Justice Coates' question, it seems to me that you want us to interpret 18.1405 subsection F, which I'm sure you're familiar with. excluding the period of delay caused the use of civic fund. How do we do that?
Okay. Well, first of all, the Adams County District Court wrote an extensive analysis of this, okay, as you know. Okay. A procedural interruption such as this does not delay speedy trial. The case of Tassard v. Yeager is on all four squares, factually, to this case. In the Tassard v. Yeager decision, Colorado Court of Appeals decision, a plea of not guilty was entered on March the 10th. And on trial counsel was offered a date on July 26th. He turned it down. He said, I'm going to the Olympics. Trial counsel was offered a date on 8/23rd. He turned it down. I have other plans or whatever. He finally took a date on August 26th. A trial was scheduled in October, and then the district attorney asked for a continuance. It was determined that the DA failed to exercise due diligence, so that continuance did not toll speedy trial. So the people argued in Tassard v. Yeager that we can go back, and if these other dates of counsel declining a trial date, if that does not toll, or if it does toll speedy trial, then we're okay. And this court in Tassard v. Yeager said no, declining a court date does not toll speedy trial.
Can I ask right there? I'm
sure.
That you would think that's on all fours. Do you think it makes any difference that the attorney there was offered several dates, chose one that was within speedy, and what the court said was that doesn't amount to a delay?
True, and we did too. July 8th was within speedy.
Well,
the court gave us some dates, and on July 8th, we accepted July 8th.
Well, but no, isn't the situation different here in that you are arguing that the date that you accepted was outside of speedy trial?
Mm-hmm. The August 3rd date, which we
did
not accept.
The ultimate date.
Which we objected to, right.
I objected to 2 days. I'm confused on the facts.
Okay, sure. Okay.
But the 2 days that you suggested were both outside of the speed trial window, is that wrong?
According to the court, according to my theory, yes. I was just telling the court what I've got available, okay? The court, and I think the case law is pretty clear that the court has the burden to ensure compliance.
It sounds like a little bit of a track record, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
So, I mean, you're aware, based on your calculation, that what you're offering is beyond the time. Right? Isn't that just what you admitted?
It is. So let me go back to this question.
Why isn't that?
Well, let's talk about waiver.
Or at least misleading to the court.
I don't think it's
misleading. You know the court is thinking that it's August 3rd. It's told us that.
Mm-hmm.
You give the court some days that are beyond your July 8th, which you're holding in your head. Are you misrepresenting the court or anything?
I don't think so. And let me tell you why.
Well, explain why.
Okay. I'm going to talk on the 6th of, on July 8th, when this all transpired, and we're dealing with the situation of when do we reschedule this trial. And the court said August 3rd, and I said that's outside of speedy trial, okay? At that juncture, you know, the right to a speedy trial is not my right. It's the defendant's right. Mr. Hills had a right to a speedy trial. Mr. Hills had the right to address this issue. It's a personal right. The court had an obligation to see if Mr. Hills was going to waive his right to a speedy trial. If the court said, look, August 3rd may or may not be within speedy trial, okay? Mr. Hills, do you waive, yes or no? If Mr. Hills said, yes, I waive speedy trial, then we wouldn't be here today. If Mr. Hills said, no, I don't waive speedy trial, then the court could have done a number of things. The court could have explored other dates. The court could have explored Division D, because you know it was a gray area as to whether August 3rd was in or out. Okay, and so it wasn't misleading to tell the court that July 27th, you know, was on my calendar. I didn't lie to the court and say July 27th is within speedy trial. I never said that. I just said, look, I've got a date. July 27th, let's deal with that. And the court said, let's deal with August 3rd. Now, Mr. Hills could have said, no, I don't waive speedy trial. Then at that juncture, and this occurs all the time in criminal courts, the court would say, well, Mr. Hills, we have a problem. Let's assume because of court congestion, they're totally booked. There's no other date that's available. June 15th, June 22, anywhere up to July 10th, there simply is no date available at all. And let's assume, and again, this is an assumption, Division B has no date because of court congestion, that truly the only date that the court could try this case was on July 6th. Okay, so what does Mr. Hills do? He then has the option to say, well then, I think speedy trial is so important that I will take that July 6th date and I'll go pro se because I have the right to represent myself. I'll get other counsel. He can make this knowing decision. A waiver of speedy trial is personal and it should be affirmative and it should be knowingly, and only Mr. Hills can do that. And so, okay.
Fred, can I ask a question?
Sure.
That concerns me. I kind of buy most of your argument that asset versus behavior is the way you read it. But what the real problem, as I see it, is that puts the speedy trial in the hands of the defense attorney. If you carry that out to his logical position, suppose you said, I'm unavailable, forever. You could be continuing that case for many moons, so to speak.
What happens, there is something that happens in that case.
Well, other than the judge getting another lawyer, in a much more serious case, that poses problems, and which is really going to apply to anything. If we write this opinion, it's going to apply to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not what just happened to the questions.
Okay.
So
I think the court has to make...
The problem is that it puts a lot of power in the hands of the defense attorney's schedule. And I guess I'd like you to address
it. Sure. It's a policy decision, and if we're talking about policy decisions, the type of court congestion that exists in the Westminster Municipal Court is probably unacceptable. It's inconsistent with the right to speedy trial to say that we can only give you one date that works at all after the court continues it is not an acceptable way of resolving the issue or balancing the question of court congestion on one hand and the right to a speedy trial on the other. Offering one date simply is not an appropriate balance in that situation. But what happens is the court says, then I want a waiver. The court never did, because as in People v. Bell, the court made a mistake. The court erred by implying that I don't need to make a waiver because August 3rd is within speedy. And that's because on this tolling theory, which is directly contrary to Tassett v. Yeager. Here's the bottom line. Is it reasonable under the obligations and all of the case law that says that the court has an affirmative duty to adhere to strict compliance of the rules and the statute, is it reasonable to offer one date and to say if that one date is not acceptable, we're going to go outside of speedy without a waiver? Is that a reasonable decision? Does that comply with the court's obligations to do everything they can to ensure a speedy trial?
Sure. You brought this up, that the court here's got some kind of practice that applies to this court. So he's definitely thinking he's with them.
Right.
He doesn't articulate or ask the question now. Do you agree that speedy is gone by August 3rd or not? I mean, there's not this colloquy. I mean, the court could have been more careful, that's for sure, it sounds like. But you're thinking one set of facts about one speedy trial. He's thinking another set. He's not thinking a waiver is necessary. Right?
True. Absolutely.
So I suppose the question on his part should have been a cautious one. What do you think the speedy day is?
And that was absolutely. But the court made really clear on June the 8th that these dates at the end of April and May toll speedy trial. I mean, he made that really, that's the policy of the court, that by declining those early dates, there is a toll. And that means then that the speedy trial started on June 1, and 63 days is, it could have gone into September based on that. Okay. And so we have an error, from our point of view, the court made an error. The court made an error of assuming that August 3rd was then speedy and simply proceeded. Because of that, the court did not really explore alternative dates, did not explore Division B, did not get a waiver of speedy trial. And as a result, the defendant, it's our position, Well, as a result, the court did not ensure strict compliance with the rule.
Mr. Brown, if I may, I'd like to distract you for a moment.
Sure.
And hopefully ask you something that you can simply explain to me and I don't understand. And that is, this case has been argued with the assumption really that the 18-1405 applies, that our prior case law applies, that the decision that we make here will be applicable for general speedy trial purposes. However, the governing rule here is 248 of the municipal rules, is it not? And isn't that rule really written differently, if not considerably differently, than the statute and also criminal rule 48? And so my question is, assuming that ought to be true, why is it that everybody is just assuming, I mean, why are you just assuming that all that prior case law in the 18-1405 applies? I mean, I guess what I'd like to propose to you is that this is simply a decision under municipal rule 248.
The Court of Appeals, both the majority and the dissent, addressed this specific issue, and they cite the Baccia case. And in that case, the Colorado Supreme Court said that we have to have harmony between the two rules. We will interpret them together. And the Court of Appeals in Hills specifically affirmed, and that's a doctrine of longstanding.
So you were basically reading that as effectively making 248, regardless of what it says, it's read as reading the same as 18-1405.
There's an effort to make it harmonious, yes.
That's a little bit different, effort to make it harmonious than ignoring the language of it altogether and simply believing that 18-1405 applies. There's effort to make it harmonious, but the language of it is, first of all, it's 90 days instead of some greater period of time, which I'm sure everyone is aware. But it also talks about sound judicial discretion, determining that additional delay is appropriate.
If we look at the municipal cases only, it's clear that error was made. Alley v. Call says that this type of delay tolls if you request an affirmative act, such as requesting a pretrial conference, and that was a municipal case. And the Cranston versus District Court was a municipal case where the defendant didn't bother to show up at all. So the municipal cases interpreting the municipal rule is even stricter and even is stronger compliance with the defendant's right to a speedy trial than the state cases. And so,
I think there is a difference between the municipal rule and
It's interesting. Obviously, the 9 days versus 6 months is a difference, but they both talk about delay. They both talk about delays that charge to the people and delays that charge to the defense. And when you look at the case law, what's important is that there is no case that says declining a court date unless you make an affirmative request or unless you agree to a date outside a speedy trial or unless you object to a date outside a speedy trial. There's no case, either municipal or state, that says that tolls speedy trial.
When would the delay be occasioned by the defendant?
If the defendant agrees to a date outside speedy trial, if the defendant has no objection to a date outside of speedy trial, if the defendant requests a pretrial conference, if the defendant requests on a diversion, there's a case involving diversion, judge, we'd like to apply for a diversion, that tolls speedy trial. If they appeal, that tolls speedy trial. But simply, there's no case that simply declining a court date does that.
If the judge had not asked you how that would work for your client, I'm setting the trial, whatever that first date was, would that change the situation? Would that fulfill his obligation as you seem to see it as reasonable to have inquired the defendant whether he wanted to go pro se or change counsel?
No, I mean, if there has to be an obligation of the court to set speedy trial in a reasonable fashion, simply imposing a date on us, I don't think that's reasonable. I think there has to be some accommodation. in our system, there has to be some accommodation, some give and take. What works, what doesn't work? How do we balance the two?
And that doesn't seem to be based, I've been trying to pick up with your distinction there about reasonable and what you consider appropriate in terms of offers and whether he asked for waiver and all of that. Doesn't seem to be based on the text of either 248 or 181405. Is that something that you consider implicit in the notion of speedy trial? Where does that come from?
Sure.
Reasonable.
Well, 248, sure. 248 talks about a delay at the request of the defendant. We don't have that. Or at the occasion of the defense, and we don't have that.
If the court offers you a date, offers the defendant a date, and he doesn't take it, is that a request at the instance of the defendant?
Not according to the Tassar v. Yeager case. It's certainly not. You know, okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Jared Balson. I'm one of the prosecutors for the City of Westminster. I'm representing them today. I have bar number 28532. Let me first address that this is a Rule 248 case and not a state statute case. But more importantly than that at this point is that this is a Rule 106 proceeding. Under those rules, 104B, he cannot get into the waiver of speedy trial issue that was decided back on the first dated issue, April 11th. So again, that's why we start on that date as a waiver of speedy trial. That can't be challenged because it's outside of the 30-day rule that the jurisdictional limits as determined by the Court of Appeals in the Slaughter case, for example, in the explicit language of 104B.
That only takes you to July
8th. It takes us to July 10th, I believe, Judge. Justice, July 10th. So that's the presumptive 90-day deadline that we operate under. This is not a case of chronic congestion. That case was Carr. In that case, for 6 months, the trial court could not offer any trial date because that court gave preference to in-custody defendants as opposed to people who weren't. Chronic trial congestion. Defense counsel argues that this is a court that has chronic congestion. That's not the case. There was one date, June 8th, that this case could not proceed. In our presumptive 90-day time frame, we have jury trials available every Friday. That's 12 Fridays. We offered 6 days of the 12. Six of the 12. We offered 5 when we were first trying to schedule the case. It came to June 8th. There was one more within speedy that we could offer to him. So this is not a case of chronic trial congestion. In this case, because it's a 106 challenge, this court doesn't have to go back to the Court of Appeals. It doesn't have to look at the Adams County court case. It goes straight to the trial court record. And I'd like to address that record briefly because it's fairly short. On the June 8th transcript, page 3, the defense counsel says, I'm going to move to dismiss on two grounds. One, that today's past speedy, but his argument had to do with prior to April 11th. The court found, no, you waived speedy trial on April 11th when he wanted substitution of counsel, so that issue were clearly within speedy trial right now. So the court responded to that argument on page 4, line 11. The alternative argument the defense counsel made on June 8th is that July 10th was the speedy trial deadline. He argued a straight 90-day calculation period, if and or buts. That ignores the language in the rule.
Which line would you rely
on? On Rule 248, the language of the rule is, unless the delay is occasioned by the action or request of the defendant. That's the language. So the court is attempting to address his motion to dismiss, saying July 10th is the deadline. And the court responds, no. The court responds, you delayed the trial setting to accommodate your schedule. The court told him that time frame was told. The court addresses that, the response to that argument, on page 4, line 15. You declined the dates. That told speedy trial. So while we'd like to get the case set within the presumptive 90-day deadline, we'll see if we can do that. I don't know if it's possible or not. So the court's still indicating we're going to try to give you a date within the presumptive, but because there's this told time, we don't necessarily have to do that. So standing there in the courtroom, he's been advised by the court, I think this time is told. So the court says, okay, how about July 6th? He says, no, how about the 13th or 27th of July? So with his argument, he's now offering, if it's a straight 90-day calculation, he's offering dates outside of that deadline. The court says, we can offer the next available date, which is August 3rd. Defense counsel suggests to you that that wasn't clearing with the other division, but that's inaccurate. The court offers the first available date in both courtrooms. The court isn't saying, I'm offering only the dates I have in this division. He's trying to create and insert something into the record that's not there. It's the first available date. So again, because it's a 248, Rule 248 case, and that specific language that is at issue, go back to statutory construction. Start at the base level. The Bates case, 1964, interpreted that exact language in the context of a state statute at that point, but that exact language. So we have a 1964 decision by this court that tells us what that language means in rules of statutory construction, the Cooper and Cook cases. If that subsequent language is used again later, then the legislature is presumed to know the meaning that this court assigned to that language. I would presume that that rule of statutory construction for the use of the legislature's language applies when you use the language and adopted and put in force Rule 248 subsequent to 1964. You knew the language had that particular meaning, and so you put it in place, and there it sits for us.
Already? Can I stop you?
Yes.
So what particular meaning, can you just say what you think the particular meaning was that was carried off?
248,
yeah, the
248 language out of Bates. In that case, it was a mistrial, not the fault of the defense. Mistrial in June 12th, midweek. Mistrial, not the fault of anybody. The court says, okay, let's try it Monday. Defense counsel, no, I can't do that. Okay, so let's see, I've got, how about October 1st? 4 months later. Can't do October 1st, almost any time after that would be fine. Okay, October 10th or 12th. That's fine, Judge, we'll do that. In Bates, they said that was clearly an example of the definitional language. Those delays were caused at the instance of the defense. They could have done the trial the following Monday in June. They declined that date. They declined August 1st, and it was set in mid-October. So that's exactly on point to what we have here with the period of time, for example, in the first setting in April when we're trying to get that first date. We've got those 5 weeks. The court's offering five available weeks in a row, not chronic congestion, five available weeks in a row. Let's get this trial done. Let's do it. The first date was, I think, 16 days out. Let's do it fast. Well, let's do it in a month. Again, the court couldn't, the defense couldn't do that. So Bates gives us the exact language at issue in our case.
And you're referring to the is occasioned by language?
The exact language at issue in our case.
Do you think that there is some difference between the 248 and the statute? I mean, is there a difference between the occasioned by the action or request that language and its caused? I mean, are you reading some sort of difference between the statutory standard and the rough standard?
I think they're very close. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would separate the two. Our language is at the request of, there is a cause language. I think they're very similar. Our Rule 248 language is almost identical, almost the same to 18-1-405-6F, the state statute. More or less follows the same language. So we have Bates giving us the exact language at issue, and this court repeatedly cites Bates. Repeatedly says, scheduling delays to accommodate defense counsel's calendar excluded from speedy trial. It does it, I think, five separate times in various Supreme Court cases. The Colantonio case, Bovino, Bell, Williamson. the Bates case isn't specifically cited, but the same language of scheduling delays to accommodate the defense counsel calendar excluded, that language appears in Fetty, although Bates isn't cited for it as the source. So this court continuously, over the course of 45 years, has gone back to that very same case of Bates.
Does that mean we have to overrule Tassett?
I think it does. Bates and Tassett cannot stand together. Colantino, 4 months after Tassett.
If we do that, doesn't that give defense counsel control over the speed trial?
If Tassett's overruled?
No. Yes.
If Tassett's overruled.
That places the onus really on defense counsel. I can't do it. Sorry.
I don't think it gives them more power. I think it's a check on their power. I think because what it would say is it would follow Bates and all the other five cases where this court has said scheduling delays are excluded. It falls within that purview. So I think Tassett, there's a problem with Tassett in that it can't stand, it stands in direct conflict with that language out of Bates, Colantino, Fetty, Lueno, Bell, and Williamson, all of your cases. Tassett stands in stark contrast. I can't take the date because I want to go to the Olympics. I can't take that date because I want to do this other trial. But I can take this other date, this third date. And in that case, Marsha Yeager argued as part of her case that that time should be excluded. And the court rejected that argument in this case. But there were a couple of funny things about Tassett. One, Tassett never cites Bates. Ignores it, I'm not sure, but it never cites Bates. Two, that was a 106 case. In a 106 case, again, this court doesn't engage in fact-finding. Neither does the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeals or the District Court. But yet, in Tassett, the Supreme Court relied on a fact determined by the District Court, not determined by the Court of, not determined by the trial court. In a Rule 106 case, this court is stuck with the findings made at the trial court level. The findings at the trial court level are the defense declined dates to accommodate his schedule. Those are the factual findings this trial court made on June 8th that this court has to look at and say, was that an abuse of discretion? Was the record so devoid of support for that position? And clearly the answer is no, because we know he declined dates to accommodate his schedule. Because it's a 106 case, it's either got to be abuse of discretion or exceeding jurisdiction. Clearly, the municipal court had the authority to be deciding a speedy trial question. In a Rule 106 case, the decision of the trial court must be affirmed, again, unless there's no competent evidence in the record to support it.
If
he applied the wrong standard, yes. But here's the standard the court applied. This court's decisions in six Supreme Court cases. The scheduling delays to accommodate defense counsel's calendar are excluded from speedy trial, starting with the Bates decision.
With regard to your argument about this being 106, we'll have trouble seeing the significance of that with regard to the standard, because we're still talking about whether the statute allowed him to do what he did.
Certainly, yes. Because it's a 106 case, this court is stuck with the factual findings. That's not new. Because this is a 106 case, this court is not evaluating the Court of Appeals decision. That's different than a typical appeal. This court is not evaluating.
Why do you say that? We're thinking that the Court of Appeals was the court of direct review.
It was.
The Court of Appeals, and it's the Court of Appeals ruling and rationale that we've accepted review on. Is it not?
That's the premise of the question for certiorari, yes. But in a 106 case, the oddity of a request for certiorari is that you got to say the last court that looked at it made some kind of error, please address that. But in a 106 case, review is limited by the rule to, does the record have support in it for the trial court's decision? So that's one of the odd things about a 106 case.
Talking here about construction of a statute.
Yes. Correct. A matter of law, which the court would do.
Judge screwed in a certain way.
Yes.
The 106 judge screwed in a certain way.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals made a determination whether, as a matter of law, the 106 judge erred in his construction, and the
Aren't we doing the same thing?
No, I don't think the Court of Appeals looked at the district court to say, did the district court make it, was the district court's analysis correct or not? The Court of Appeals correctly, I think, looked at the trial court record because of the standard of review limited by the 106 rule. The Court of Appeals looked at the trial court, set aside more or less the district court. This court does the same thing. This court isn't in a 106 case. This court looks at the trial court record and says, again, is there something in the record that supports the decision? In this case, there is. So it's just one of the oddities of a Rule 106 case.
Well,
yes?
What about the second case? Is your position that by saying I'm not available July 6th, at that period from June 8th to July 6th was occasion of that side speech?
Let me clarify the question. From the period of June 8th to July 6th counts against the people.
Counts against the people.
Why? No doubt about that.
Why?
Well, for one, the trial court couldn't hear it on the 8th, and so that delay is not attributable to the defense. That initial period of delay till we can find a new court date is held against the people. But once you get to July 6th, once it's the defense unavailability at that point that's delaying the trial setting, that's when the tolling starts. And let me make another point, because this was addressed by someone. We are not arguing that from April 11th to April 27th is counted against the defense. That is not our argument. We accept, we acknowledge that April 11th to the first date that he could not make, well, that time is counted against the people. Again, it's only those periods of time that he could not make trial that are excluded under the rule.
That's a question about the rule and statute here. I'm following up on this. The rule tells you what happens if you fail to try the defendant within speedy, and it wasn't his, and the delay wasn't caused by him. It doesn't purport to tell you at all what to do if there is a delay caused by him, does it? Aren't you looking for the statute to decide whether you exclude time?
I don't believe we are. 248B. If there's unnecessary delay in the trial of a defendant, the court can dismiss the case. That's the first sentence. You can dismiss it at any time if there's a delay. But the second line, if the trial of the defendant is delayed more than 90 days after the arraignment of the defendant, or unless the delay is occasioned by the action or request of the defendant, the court shall dismiss the case. And the rest of the language isn't at issue here.
So, it doesn't say anything about excluding time.
Well, the Court of Appeals has interpreted Rule 248 to allow for waivers of speedy trial and for tolling of time. So those two cases are the Crandall case and Alley v. Cow.
Well, I guess I'm not sure what they've decided. Let me put it to you this way. We're into this problem of isolating. How does the rule play in with the statute? How do we look at it? It does appear to me that the rule by itself doesn't tell us anything about excluding time. The statute is much more specific. Justice Bender mentioned the 405 sub 6F, which is excluding time that was caused at the delay at the instance of the defendant. 405.3 says if the defendant is asked for a continuance, which sounds a lot like a request here, perhaps in 248, we don't deduct time, but rather start a new 6 months running over again. I'm concerned about how you come up with what to do, depending on whether the defendant is considered to have taken action that caused the delay, or whether he's made a request, because we don't have that kind of specificity that we have in the statute, unless you're going to analogize to the statute. And you seem to be saying we don't. We look at the rules separately.
I think you can rely on the rule because the Bates opinion gives you the meaning of this language. The meaning of this language is, under the Bates case, when you say, I can't do it this coming Monday, and in fact, I can't do it 4 months from now in October, I can only do it beginning in mid-October, in the Bates case, they say that's exactly the reason for this language. That's the exact kind of delay that this language is meant to address.
So in Bates, they suggest that this particular language tells you when to exclude time or how to calculate further time?
It's one of the cases that does that, yes. Decided back in 1964. This court has again, Bates did not contain that line, scheduling delays to accommodate defense counsel's schedule are excluded. Doesn't contain that line. That language is the paraphrase this court has put on that decision in its subsequent decisions of Colantino, Lueno, Bell, and Williamson. That's the tagline this court has attached to the Bates decision. Yes, Justice Bender, I apologize. Back to the Rule 106 standard of review. The IBC case says that if there's more than one basis for the trial court's determination, the challenging party must overcome all basis for the determination. In this case, there are two ways to get past the August 3rd trial date, the period of the initial delay in scheduling what turned out to be the June 8th trial, and then there's the second delay having to do with the declining the July 6th date, which results in getting to August 3rd. Looking at the Adams County District Court opinion, for example, in its opinion, it only addresses the second period of delay. But in doing so, it says there's two different lines of cases. One is scheduling delays to accommodate counsel, but that doesn't apply here because I'm only going to look at the last period of delay. Well, in his dissent, opinion, the district court judge gave you all the reasons why that first period of delay, again, is attributable to the defense. It's the same cases that I've cited for you already. Let's see here. Defense counsel suggests in his argument, in his brief, and today, that the court should have been asking for a waiver of the defendant in order to set the case to August 3rd. One, you don't have to have defendant's permission to set a case within Speedy, obviously. But two, he's saying that you should have asked me if my client would waive Speedy trial when I'm standing before the court saying I'm moving to dismiss because I think, one, Speedy trial's already expired, and two, that the deadline is just around the corner and we're not going to accept anything beyond that. So I don't, there's no case out there, there's no text that says the judge must ask for a waiver before he can set the case. Yes, sir.
Policy behind a lot of the cases says the responsibility of the court and the prosecution to set the trial within the speedy trial.
Absolutely. So no dispute about that.
Obviously, if you have a date that extends it, then the obligation is to get a waiver. Otherwise, you don't extend it.
Well, but there's no waiver necessary if speedy trial has been told, the clock hasn't been running, thus the presumptive deadline was extended. Because if it's extended, then it's not run, and you don't need a waiver for that. And that 35-day delay from the initial time frame gets us past August 3rd. This court had questions. Justice Coates, I think, asked the question about can't you just set this trial over the objection of the defense? There are two cases that did exactly that, the Chavez case and the Wilson case. In the Chavez case, the court realized that, wait a minute, we've got a date beyond speedy trial. We need to reevaluate. We need to get this within speedy trial. The attorney was saying, I can't do it before speedy trial. There's no possible way. And so the trial court, the Court of Appeals in the Chavez case says, when you're telling the court, I can't possibly do it within speedy trial, then you are asking for a motion to continue, which is a waiver of speedy trial. And so that's what they did. They set it on a date. They were going to make them waive. But the same thing happened in the Wilson case. We're going to set it on a date when we know that you can't be here. What that means is I know as a trial court judge that you're going to have to file a motion to continue. When you file a motion to continue, you're going to waive speedy trial. That policy, that argument, that line of cases actually is in derogation of the right to a speedy trial more than the policy that this court has set up, which is only that time period of unavailability, defense counsel's unavailability, is excluded. So in the Wilson case, the trial court said, set it on January 2nd. Had defense counsel said, Judge, I can't do it then, but I can do it in 2 weeks. I'm available in 2 weeks. Then instead of getting a waiver of speedy trial, meaning the case could be set and heard in May in the Chavez case, you told the time frame a couple of weeks until that defense attorney is available. The defendant maintains his priority based upon a speedy trial calculation. He's on top of the list. His case is going to get resolved faster, and it protects his right to a trial. He gets his trial sooner rather than later. The standard of review, I think, is the most important thing in terms of what this court is being asked to do. Look at the trial court record, determine if there's evidence or support in the record for the decision made. Did the trial court apply the right standard as stated by this court six different times? And clearly the answer is yes, the trial court did that. We don't dispute that it is our obligation to make a record, the court and the prosecutor. And you don't look at just the end time frame. The last case, the last reason that the speedy trial, the last continuance resulting in a trial setting where the defense alleges it's outside of speedy trial, that is not what you do. But that's what the district court did. The district court said, I'm only going to look at the very last continuance resulting in the setting where the defense counsel alleges the delay. In the base case, they didn't do that. In the base case, they looked at the very first date offered, 3 or 4 days from now. Midweek mistrial, let's do it on Monday. The Supreme Court in Bates says, you said you couldn't do that. That's a delay at your request. That same process has been done in the Chavez case, in the Wilson case, and the Alley v. Cal case, where the court has looked at the entire speedy trial time frame. Why was this delay in the trial setting? Why did this delay occur? Why did this delay occur? You pick and choose. You cut and carve the speedy trial period. You don't look at the last delay only, which is what the district court did. So there are two reasons that support the trial court's decision, the first delay, the second delay. The district court didn't look at the period of the first delay. The Court of Appeals specifically said, we think that the defense hasn't even tried to argue that the first period of delay is an issue, so we're not even going to address it. So the Court of Appeals didn't look at that first time frame. But under the IBC decision, a 106 decision, you go back, and if there's more than one basis, the defendant, in this case, has to overcome every single one of those bases. He cannot overcome the trial court's record, the fact finding. These time frames were rejected because you were unavailable. He cannot overcome that fact that the trial court made. In a 106 case, this court can't reweigh the evidence to determine or decide, for example, that it would come up with a different position. That has been addressed many times in Rule 106 context. We believe that the August 3rd date was within speedy trial. We ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court, finding that there is support in the record for the decision, and the defendant has not overcome the burden of the challenge to every basis for that decision. Thank you.
Is the court going to allow a brief reply?
I think you exhausted your time. Well, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case stands submitted.